it's always live, which feels and maybe is close to being alive. Of course, it's hard to argue that CNN has brought the world together in brotherhood and kindness. There's something nauseating about Ted Turner's capitalist idealism, the notion that we can change the world for the better and make billions of dollars for one man. But I do think CNN provides a service. It does a fair bit of investigative journalism, which can uncover corruption and injustice that otherwise would go unchecked. Also, CNN does report the news, at least in a narrow sense. If it happened today, and it was dramatic or scary or big, and if it happened in the US or Europe, you will probably learn about it on CNN. The word news tells a secret on itself, though. What's news isn't primarily what is noteworthy or important, but what is new. So much of what actually changes in human life isn't driven by events, but instead by processes, which often aren't considered news. We don't see much about climate change on CNN, unless a new report is published, nor do we see regular coverage of other ongoing crises, like child mortality or poverty. A 2017 study found that 74% of Americans believe that global child mortality has either stayed the same or gotten worse in the last 20 years, when, in fact, it has declined by almost 60% since 1990, by far the fastest decline in child death in any 30-year period in human history. One of the very few bright spots of 2020 is that child mortality continued to decline globally, but it is still much, much too high. A child born in Sierra Leone is 12 times more likely to die before the age of 5 than a child born in Sweden. And as Dr. Joya Mukherjee points out in An Introduction to Global Health Delivery, these differences in life expectancy are not caused by genetics, biology, or culture. Health inequities are caused by poverty, racism, lack of medical care, and other social forces that influence health. But to watch CNN, you might not know that child mortality is declining. You also might not know that in 2020, global rates of death from war were at or near the lowest they've been in centuries. Even when a news story does receive saturation coverage, as the global disease pandemic did on CNN beginning in March of 2020, there is often a preference for event-based stories over process-based ones. The phrase grim milestone is repeated over and over as we learn that 100,000 and then 200,000 and then 500,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the United States. But without context, what do these numbers even mean? The constant repetition of grim milestones without any historical grounding only has a distancing effect, at least for me. But when contextualized, the grimness of the milestone comes into focus. One could report, for instance, that in 2020, average U.S. life expectancy fell much further than it has in any year since World War II. Because there is always new news to report, we rarely get the kind of background information that allows us to understand why the news is happening. We learn that hospitals have run out of ICU beds to treat gravely ill COVID-19 patients, but we do not learn of the decades-long series of choices that led to a U.S. healthcare system that privileged efficiency over capacity. This flood of information without context can so easily and so quickly transform into misinformation. Over 150 years ago, the American humorist Josh Billings wrote, "I honestly believe it is better to know nothing than to know what ain't so." And that seems to me the underlying problem, not just with CNN and other cable news networks, but with contemporary information flow in general. so often I end up knowing what just ain't so. In 2003, I was living with my three best friends, Katie, Shannon, and Hassan, in an apartment on the northwest side of Chicago. We'd survived those early post-college years where life, for me at least, felt overwhelming and intensely unstable. Until I moved in with Shannon and Katie and Hassan, everything I owned could fit into my car. My life had been, to borrow a line from Milan Kundera, unbearably light. But now, things were settling down in wonderful ways. We had our first semi-permanent jobs and our first semi-permanent furniture. We even had a television with cable. But mostly, we had one another. That apartment, the walls all painted very bright colors, no sound insulation, only one bathroom, tiny bedrooms, huge common areas, was designed for us to be in it together, to be in every part of life together. And we were. We loved one another with a ferocity that unnerved outsiders. I once went on a few dates with someone who told me one night that my friend group seemed like a cult. When I told Shannon and Katie and Hassan about this, we all agreed that I needed to break off the relationship immediately. "But that's what we would say if we were a cult," Katie said. Hassan nodded and deadpanned. "Ah, shit, guys. We're a cult." I know I am romanticizing this past. We also had huge fights. We had our hearts broken. We got too drunk and fought over who would get to puke into the one toilet, etc. But it was the first extended period of my adult life where I felt okay even some of the time. And so you'll forgive me if I recall it with such fondness. That August, I turned 26, and we threw a dinner party called "John Green Has Outlived John Keats," and everybody who attended had to read some poetry. Someone read Edna St. Vincent Millay. "My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes, and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light." A few days later, the owners of the building told us they were selling it. But even if they hadn't, the apartment would have split up eventually. The big forces of human life, marriage, careers, immigration policy, were pulling us in different directions. But our candle gave a lovely light. We were living in that apartment during the U.S.'s 2003 invasion of Iraq. Hassan grew up in Kuwait, and he had family members living in Iraq at the time. For a few weeks after the invasion, he didn't hear from them. He would eventually learn that they were okay, but it was a scary time, and one of the ways he coped was by watching cable news almost all the time. And because we only had one TV and we were constantly together, that meant the rest of us watched a lot of cable news as well. Even though the war was covered 24 hours a day, very little background information ever entered the picture. The news talked a fair amount about the relationship between Shia and Sunni Muslims in Iraq, for instance, but never paused to explain the theological differences between Shias and Sunnis, or the history of Iraq, or the political ideology of the Ba'athist movement. There was so much news that was forever breaking, that there was never time for context. One evening, just after the U.S.-led forces entered Baghdad, we were all watching the news on the couch together. Unedited footage was being broadcast from the city, and we watched as a cameraman panned across a home with a huge hole in one of its walls that was mostly covered by a piece of plywood. There was Arabic graffiti scrawled in black spray paint on the plywood, and the reporter on the news was talking about the anger in the street and the hatred. Hassan started to laugh. I asked him what was so funny, and he said, "The graffiti." And I said, "What's funny about it?" Hassan answered, "It says, 'Happy birthday, sir,' despite the circumstances." On a minute-by-minute basis, it's hard for any of us to consider the happy birthday, sir, despite the circumstances, possibility. I project my expectations and fears onto everyone and everything I encounter. I believe that what I believe to be true must be true because I believe it. I imagine lives that feel distant from mine monolithically. I oversimplify. I forget that everyone has birthdays. Good journalism seeks to correct for those biases, to help us toward a deeper understanding of the universe and our place in it. But when we can't read the writing on the plywood, but still think we know what it says, we are spreading ignorance and bigotry, not the peace and friendship Turner promised. I give CNN 2 stars. Harvey. The movie Harvey stars Jimmy Stewart as Elwood P. Dowd, an alcoholic whose best friend is a 6-foot-3.5-inch-tall, invisible white rabbit named Harvey. Josephine Hull won an Oscar for her portrayal of Elwood's sister, Vita, who struggles with whether to commit Elwood to a sanitarium. The film, based on Mary Chase's Pulitzer Prize-winning play of the same name, was an immediate critical and commercial success when it was released in 1950. As Bosley Crowther put it in the New York Times, if a visit to the Astor, where it opened yesterday, does not send you forth into the highways and byways embracing a warm glow, then the fault will be less with Harvey, we suspect, than it will be with you. But my story of Harvey begins in the early winter of 2001, shortly after I suffered what used to be known as a nervous breakdown. I was working for Booklist magazine and living on the near north side of Chicago in a small apartment that I had until recently shared with a person I'd thought I would marry. At the time, I believed that our breakup had caused my depression. But now, I see that my depression, at least in part, caused the breakup. Regardless, I was alone in what had been our apartment, surrounded by what had been our things, trying to take care of what had been our cat. Susan Sontag wrote that depression is melancholy minus its charms. For me, living with depression was at once utterly boring and absolutely excruciating. Psychic pain overwhelmed me, consuming my thoughts so thoroughly that I no longer had any thoughts, only pain. In Darkness Visible, William Styron's wrenching memoir of depression, he wrote, "What makes the condition intolerable is the foreknowledge that no remedy will come, not in a day, an hour, a month, or a minute. If there is mild relief, one knows that it is only temporary. More pain will follow. It is hopelessness, even more than pain, that crushes the soul. I find hopelessness to be a kind of pain, one of the worst kinds. For me, finding hope is not some philosophical exercise or sentimental notion. It is a prerequisite for my survival." In the winter of 2001, I had the foreknowledge that no remedy would come, and it was agonizing. I became unable to eat food, so instead I was drinking 2 2-liter bottles of Sprite per day, which is approximately the right number of calories to consume, but not an ideal nutrition strategy. I remember coming home from work and lying on the peeling linoleum of what had been our kitchen and looking through the Sprite bottle at the green parabolic rectangle of the kitchen window. I watched the bubbles inside the bottle clinging to the bottom, trying to hold on, but inevitably floating up to the top. I thought about how I couldn't think. I felt the pain pressing in on me, like it was an atmosphere. All I wanted was to be separated from the pain, to be free from it. Eventually, a day came when I could not pick myself up off that linoleum floor, and I spent a very long Sunday thinking about all the ways that the situation might resolve itself. That evening, thank God, I called my parents, and thank God, they answered. My parents are busy people with demanding lives who lived 1,500 miles away from Chicago, and they were at my apartment within 12 hours of that phone call. A plan formed quickly. I would leave my job, go home to Florida, get into daily counseling or possibly inpatient treatment. They packed up my apartment. My ex kindly agreed to take the cat. The only thing left was to quit my job. I loved working at Booklist, and I loved my coworkers, but I also knew that my life was in danger. I tearfully told my supervisor that I had to quit, and after giving me a hug as I cried, he told me to talk to the magazine's publisher, Bill Ott. I thought of Bill as a character out of a noir mystery novel. His incisive wit is both thrilling and intimidating. When I went into his office, he was surrounded by proof pages of the magazine, and he didn't look up until I closed the door. I told him that something was wrong with my head, that I hadn't eaten solid food in a couple of weeks, and that I was quitting to move home to Florida with my parents. He was silent for a long time after I finished. Bill is a master of pauses. And then at last, he said, why don't you just go home for a few weeks and see how you feel? And I said, but you'll need someone to do my job. Again, he paused. Don't take this the wrong way, kid, but I think we'll get by. At one point that afternoon, I started throwing up, excessive Sprite consumption, maybe. And when I came back to my desk to finish packing up my belongings, there was a note from Bill. I still have it. It reads, John, I stopped by to say goodbye. Hope all goes well, and you're back here in 2 weeks with an appetite that would put a longshoreman to shame. Now, more than ever, watch Harvey. Bill. For years, Bill had been bothering me to watch Harvey, and I steadfastly maintained that black and white movies were universally terrible on account of how the special effects quality is poor and nothing ever happens except people talking. I was back in Orlando, where I'd grown up. It felt like such a failure to be there, living with my parents, unable to do much of anything. I felt like I was nothing but a burden. My thoughts whirled and swirled. I couldn't ever think straight. I couldn't concentrate enough to read or write. I was in daily therapy and taking a new medication, but I felt certain it would not work, because I didn't think the problem was chemical. I thought the problem was me, at my core. I was worthless, useless, helpless, hopeless. I was less and less each day. One night, my parents and I rented Harvey. Because it was adapted from a play, Harvey is, as I feared, a talky movie. Most of it takes place in only a few locations: the house Elwood P. Dowd shares with his older sister and his niece, the sanitarium where many believe Elwood belongs because his best friend is an invisible rabbit, and the bar where Elwood likes to hang out and drink. Mary Chase's dialogue is magnificent throughout, but I especially love Elwood's soliloquies. Here is Elwood talking about chatting with strangers at the bar. They tell me about the big, terrible things they've done and the wonderful things they'll do, their hopes and their regrets and their loves and their hates, all very large, because nobody ever brings anything small into a bar. In another scene, Elwood tells his psychiatrist, I've wrestled with reality for 35 years, doctor, and I'm happy to state I finally won out over it. Elwood is mentally ill. He's not much of a contributor to society. It'd be easy to characterize him as worthless or hopeless. But he is also extraordinarily kind, even in difficult situations. At one point, his psychiatrist says, "This sister of yours is at the bottom of a conspiracy against you. She's trying to persuade me to lock you up. Today, she had commitment papers drawn up. She has the power of attorney over you." Elwood replies, "My sister did all that in one afternoon. That Vita certainly is a whirlwind, isn't she?" Despite not being a traditional hero of any kind, Elwood is profoundly heroic. In my favorite line of the movie, he says, "Years ago, my mother used to say to me, she'd say, 'In this world, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant.' Well, for years, I was smart. I recommend pleasant." In December of 2001, there was perhaps no human alive on Earth who needed to hear those words more than I did. I don't believe in epiphanies. My blinding light awakenings always prove fleeting. But I'll tell you this, I have never felt quite as hopeless since watching Harvey as I did just before I watched it. A couple months after watching Harvey, I was able to return to Chicago and to Booklist. Although my recovery was halting and often precarious, I got better. It was probably the therapy and the medication, of course. But Elwood played his part. He showed me that you could be crazy and still be human, still be valuable, and still be loved. Elwood offered me a kind of hope that wasn't bullshit, and in doing so, helped me to see that hope is the correct response to the strange, often terrifying miracle of consciousness. Hope is not easy or cheap. It is true. As Emily Dickinson put it, hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. I still sometimes stop hearing the tune. I still become enveloped by the abject pain of hopelessness. But hope is singing all the while. It's just that again and again and again, I must relearn how to listen. I hope you never find yourself on the floor of your kitchen. I hope you never cry in front of your boss, desperate with pain. But if you do, I hope they will give you some time off and tell you what Bill told me. Now, more than ever, watch Harvey. I give Harvey 5 stars. The Yips. On October 3rd, 2000, a 21-year-old pitcher named Rick Ankiel took the mound for the St. Louis Cardinals in the first game of a Major League Baseball playoff series. It occurs to me that you may not know the rules of baseball, but for our purposes, all you need to know is that, broadly speaking, professional pitchers throw baseballs very fast, sometimes over 100 miles per hour, and with astonishing accuracy. Pitchers who can consistently place their throws within a few square inches of space are often said to have good control. Rick Ankiel had great control. He could put the ball wherever he wanted. Even when he was in high school, the professional scouts marveled at his control. They said the kid was a machine. But about a third of the way into that playoff game in 2000, Rick Ankiel threw a very low pitch, so low that the catcher missed it, a so-called wild pitch. Ankiel had only thrown 3 wild pitches all season, but now, suddenly, he couldn't regain his control. He threw another wild pitch, this one over the batter's head, then another, another, another. He was quickly pulled from the game. A week later, Ankiel started another playoff game. He threw 5 wild pitches in 20 attempts. After that, he never consistently found the strike zone again. Ankiel won a few more games as a major league pitcher, but he couldn't fully recover his control. He sought all kinds of medical attention and even began drinking huge amounts of vodka during games to dull his anxiety, but his pitching never came back. He had contracted the yips. The kid, it turned out, was not a machine. Kids never are. Rick Ankiel wasn't the first baseball player to forget how to throw. In fact, the phenomenon is sometimes called Steve Blass disease or Steve Sack syndrome, after other baseball players who suffered sudden onset throwing challenges. It's not unique to baseball either. In 2008, an introverted 20-year-old tennis player named Anna Ivanovic won the French Open and became the top-ranked tennis player in the world. Commentators imagined her winning a host of Grand Slams and maybe even becoming a formidable rival to all-time great Serena Williams. But shortly after that French Open title, Ivanovic began to experience the yips. Not when hitting the ball or swinging the racket, but when tossing the ball before serving. From footwork to swing mechanics, tennis requires precise movements and profound bodily coordination. Throwing the ball straight up in the air before serving is just about the only part of tennis that isn't difficult. But when Ivanovic began to experience the yips, her hand would jerk mid-toss, and the ball would drift to the right or too far forward. Former tennis pro Pat Cash described watching Ivanovic's serve as a painful experience, and it truly was. But if watching it is a painful experience, how much more painful to be the server, unable to toss the ball the way she had her entire career, ever since she took up tennis as a 5-year-old in Belgrade? You could see the torment in her eyes. Watching someone struggle with the yips is like watching a school play in which a kid forgets their line. Time stops, attempts to disguise the discomfort, a little smile, a wave of apology, only heighten everyone's awareness of the anguish. You know they don't want your pity, but you offer it anyway, which only furthers the shame. She has absolutely no confidence in herself, tennis great Martina Navratilova said of Ivanovic, which was no doubt true, but how could you be confident? All serious athletes know the yips are possible, that they happen to people, but knowing something abstractly is different from knowing it experientially. Once you've known the yips personally, you can't unknow them. Every time you toss a tennis ball for the rest of your life, you'll know what could happen. How can you regain confidence when you know that confidence is just a varnish painted atop human frailty? Ivanovic once said of the yips, "If you start thinking about how you come down the stairs and think about how each muscle is working, you can't go down the stairs. But if you've fallen down the stairs, it becomes impossible not to think about how you come down the stairs." "I'm a person who overthinks and overanalyzes everything," Ivanovic went on to say. "So if you give me one thought, it creates a lot more." The yips have many names: whiskey fingers, the waggles, the freezing. But I like yips because it's such an anxious word. I can almost feel the muscle twitch inside the word itself. The yips are most common among golfers. Around a third of serious golfers struggle with them. Golfing yips usually appear when golfers are trying to hit putts, and people have tried all kinds of cures to stop the spasms. Right-handed golfers might putt left-handed, or they might try unconventional grips or long putters or short ones or bending over the club and anchoring it against the chest. And the yips don't only affect putting. One of the world's leading golf coaches can only effectively swing a driver while looking away from the ball. The yips do not seem to be a result of performance anxiety, although anxiety can worsen the problem, as it worsens many physiological problems from diarrhea to dizziness. Some golfers, for instance, feel the yips when they play on a course, but not when practicing on a putting green. I get the yips when playing tennis on forehand shots. My arm muscles jerk just before the racket hits the ball, and like that golfing coach, the only way I've found to avoid the yips is to glance away from the ball as I swing. But weirdly, I don't feel the yips when I'm warming up or hitting with a friend, only when we're keeping score. Their situational nature has led some to argue that the yips can be cured by psychotherapy, specifically by processing traumatic events in one's sporting life. I am a big fan of psychotherapy and have benefited tremendously from it, but I do not have traumatic memories of tennis. I like tennis. I just can't hit forehands while looking at the ball. Of course, just as anxiety can cause physiological problems can also cause anxiety. For professional athletes, the yips are a threat not just to their livelihood, but also to their identity. The answer to the question, who is Anna Ivanovich, was invariably, Anna Ivanovich is a tennis player. Rick Ankiel was a pitcher. Until the yips. This complicated interplay between the so-called physical and the so-called psychological reminds us that the mind-body dichotomy isn't overly simplistic. It's complete bullshit. The body is always deciding what the brain will think about, and the brain is all the time deciding what the body will do and feel. Our brains are made out of meat, and our bodies experience thoughts. When we talk about sports, we almost always talk about winning as the measure of success. Vince Lombardi famously said, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." But I'm dubious of that worldview, in sports as well as outside of them. I think a lot of the pleasure in sports is found in performing well. At first, winning is a sign that you are getting better. And then, as you age, winning becomes proof that you still have it, the it being control and competence. You can't decide whether you get sick, or whether people you love die, or whether a tornado tears apart your house, but you can decide whether to throw a curveball or a fastball. You can at least decide that, until you can't. But even after age or the yips steals away your control, you need not give up. In To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch defines courage by saying, "It's when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway." Anna Ivanovich never recovered the ability to toss the ball the way she did before the yips. But over time, she invented a new serve. It was less powerful and more predictable, but she became a top five player again, winning four tournaments in 2014. She retired a couple years later, at the age of 29. Rick Ankiel sunk all the way down to the lowest minor leagues of professional baseball. He missed the 2002 season with an injury and then blew his arm out completely in 2003. After recovering from surgery, he briefly returned to the major leagues, but he couldn't find his control. So in 2005, at the age of 26, he decided he wouldn't be a pitcher anymore. He would play in the outfield. In professional baseball, pitchers don't just become outfielders. The game is much too highly specialized for that. The last player to have a career that included winning over 10 games as a pitcher and hitting over 50 home runs as a hitter was Babe Ruth, who retired in 1935. Like Ivanovich, Rick Ankiel was licked before he began, but he began anyway. He played as an outfielder in the minor leagues, steadily improving as a hitter, and then one day in 2007, 6 years removed from the wild pitch that took away his control forever, the St. Louis Cardinals called Rick Ankiel back to the major leagues as an outfielder. When Ankiel went to bat for the first time, the game had to be paused because the crowd's standing ovation was so long and so loud. Rick Ankiel hit a home run in that game. 2 days later, he hit two more home runs. His throws from the outfield were phenomenally accurate, among the best in baseball. He would go on to play as a center fielder in the major leagues for 6 more years. Today, the most recent player to have won over 10 games as a pitcher and hit over 50 home runs as a hitter is Rick Ankiel. I give the Yips 1.5 stars. Auld Lang Syne. I find it fascinating that in a world where so much is so new, we welcome a new year by singing Auld Lang Syne, which is a very old song. The chorus starts out, "For Auld Lang Syne, my Jo, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet, for Auld Lang Syne." Jo is a Scots word that can be straightforwardly translated to dear, but Auld Lang Syne is more complicated. It literally means something like old long since, but it's idiomatically akin to the old times. We have a phrase in English somewhat similar to for Auld Lang Syne, for old time's sake. Here's a bit of my old long since. In the summer of 2001, the writer Amy Krauss Rosenthal emailed Booklist magazine to inquire about a review. At the time, I was working for Booklist as a publishing assistant. Most of my job was data entry, but I also answered many of the low-priority emails that came in. I responded to Amy with an update on the status of the review, and I also mentioned that on a personal note, I loved her zine-like column in Might magazine. I told her I often thought about one snippet she'd written, which went, "Every time I'm flying and the captain announces the beginning of our descent, the same thing goes through my mind. While we're still pretty high above the city, I'll think, if the plane went down now, we would definitely not be okay. A bit lower, and no, we still wouldn't be okay. But as we get real close to the ground, I'll relax. Okay, we're low enough now. If it crashed now, we might be okay." She wrote me back the next day and asked if I was a writer, and I said I was trying to be, and she asked if I had anything that was 2 minutes long that might work on the radio. We don't really know when Auld Lang Syne was written. The first verse goes, "Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and Auld Lang Syne?" Versions of those lyrics date back at least 400 years, but we owe the current song to the great Scottish poet Robert Burns. In December of 1788, he wrote to his friend Francis Dunlop, "Is not the Scotch phrase Auld Lang Syne exceedingly expressive? There is an old song and tune which has often thrilled through my soul. Light be the turf on the breast of the heaven-inspired poet who composed this glorious fragment." On the back side of the letter, Burns wrote a draft of the poem. At least 3 of the verses were probably his own, although he would later say of the song that he, quote, "took it down from an old man." Part of what makes dating the first verse difficult is the poem's eternality. It's about drinking together and remembering old times, and almost every idea in the song, from picking daisies to wandering through fields to toasting old friends over a beer, could have been written 500 or 1,000 or even 3,000 years ago. It is also, incidentally, a rousing ode to splitting the check, with part of the second verse going, "And surely you'll buy your pint cup, and surely I'll buy mine." But mostly, the song is just an unapologetic celebration of the good old days. I guess I should tell you that Amy is dead. Otherwise, her death within this review might seem like some kind of narrative device, which I don't want. So, okay, she is dead. The rare present tense sentence that, once it becomes true, stays true forever. But we are not there yet. We were still in the past, I think. Amy asked if I had anything for the radio, and I sent her 3 mini essays, and she liked one of them and asked me to come in and record it for her show on Chicago's public radio station, WBEZ. After that, Amy invited me to be on her show more often. Within a year, I was recording frequent commentaries for WBEZ and then for NPR's All Things Considered. In April of 2002, Amy convened some of her writer and musician friends for an event at the Chopin Theater in Chicago called Writer's Block Party. She asked me to read for it, and I did, and people laughed at my dumb jokes. Amy hired someone to walk around the theater giving everyone compliments, and the complimenter said they liked my shoes, which were new Adidas sneakers. And that's why I have worn Adidas sneakers nearly every day for the last 19 years. Robert Burns originally had a different tune in mind for Auld Lang Syne than the one most of us know, and although he himself realized that the melody was mediocre, you will sometimes still hear that original arrangement. It is used, for example, in the 2008 film Sex and the City. The tune most associated with Auld Lang Syne first appeared in 1799 in George Thompson's A Select Collection of Original Scottish Airs for the Voice. By then, Robert Burns was gone. He was only 37 when he died of a heart condition, possibly exacerbated by his habit of raising many a pint glass to old acquaintances. In his last letter, he wrote to his friend Francis Dunlop, "An illness which has long hung about me, in all probability will speedily send me beyond that bourne whence no traveler returns." Even on his deathbed, Burns could turn a phrase. Within a few decades of Burns's death, Auld Lang Syne had become a popular part of New Year's Eve celebrations in Scotland, a holiday known as Hogmanay that can trace its history back to winter solstice rituals. By 1818, Beethoven had written an arrangement of the song, and it was beginning to travel throughout the world. Between 1945 and 1948, the tune was used in South Korea's national anthem. In the Netherlands, its melody inspired one of the country's most famous football chants. Auld Lang Syne is often played at Japanese department stores just before they close to let customers know it's time to leave. The song is also a staple of film soundtracks, from Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush in 1925, to It's a Wonderful Life in 1946, to Minions in 2015. I think Auld Lang Syne is popular in Hollywood not just because it's in the public domain and therefore cheap, but also because it's the rare song that is genuinely wistful. It acknowledges human longing without romanticizing it, and it captures how each new year is a product of all the old ones. When I sing Auld Lang Syne on New Year's Eve, I forget the words like most of us do, until I get to the fourth verse, which I do have memorized. "We two have paddled in the stream from morning sun till dine, but seas between us broad have roared since Auld Lang Syne." And I think about the many broad seas that have roared between me and the past. Seas of neglect, seas of time, seas of death. I'll never again speak to many of the people who loved me into this moment, just as you will never speak to many of the people who loved you into your now. So we raise a glass to them and hope that perhaps somewhere they are raising a glass to us. In 2005, Amy published a memoir in the form of an encyclopedia called Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life. That book ends, "I was here, you see. I was." Another sentence that, once it becomes true, never stops being true. Her encyclopedia came out just a few months before my first novel, Looking for Alaska. Shortly thereafter, Sarah got into graduate school at Columbia, and so we moved to New York. Amy and I stayed in touch and collaborated occasionally over the next decade. I played a bit part in an experience she curated for hundreds of people on August 8, 2008, in Chicago's Millennium Park. But it was never again like it had been in those early days. In her strange and beautiful interactive memoir, Textbook Amy Krauss Rosenthal, published in 2016, she wrote, "If one is generously contracted 80 years, that amounts to 29,220 days on Earth. Playing that out, how many times then, really, do I get to look at a tree? 12,395? There has to be an exact number. Let's just say it is 12,395. Absolutely, that is a lot, but it is not infinite, and anything less than infinite seems too measly a number and is not satisfactory." In her writing, Amy often sought to reconcile the infinite nature of consciousness and love and yearning with the finite nature of the universe and all that inhabits it. Toward the end of Textbook, she wrote a multiple-choice question. "In the alley, there is a bright pink flower peeking out through the asphalt. A, it looks like futility. B, it looks like hope." For me, at least, Auld Lang Syne captures exactly what it feels like to see a bright pink flower peeking out through the asphalt, and how it feels to know that you have 12,395 times to look at a tree. Amy found out she had cancer not long after finishing Textbook, and she called me. She knew that in the years after my book The Fault in Our Stars was published, I'd come to know many young people who were gravely ill, and she wanted to know if I had advice for her. I told her what I think is true, that love survives death. But she wanted to know how young people react to death, how her kids would. She wanted to know if her kids and her husband would be okay. And that ripped me up. Although I'm usually quite comfortable talking with sick people, with my friend, I found myself stumbling over words, overwhelmed by my own sadness and worry. They won't be okay, of course, but they will go on, and the love you poured into them will go on. That's what I should have said, but what I actually said, while crying, was, "How can this be happening? You do so much yoga." In my experience, dying people often have wonderful stories of the horrible things healthy people say to them, but I've never heard of anybody saying something as stupid as, "You do so much yoga." I hope that Amy at least got some narrative mileage out of it, but I also know I failed her after she was there for me so many times. I know she forgives me, present tense, but still, I desperately wish I could have said something useful, or perhaps not said anything at all. When people we love are suffering, we want to make it better. But sometimes, often, in fact, you can't make it better. I'm reminded of something my supervisor said to me when I was a student chaplain. "Don't just do something. Stand there." Auld Lang Syne was a popular song during World War I. Versions of it were sung in trenches not just by British soldiers, but by French and German and Austrian ones as well. And the song even played a small role in one of the strangest and most beautiful moments in world history, the Christmas Truce of 1914. On Christmas Eve that year, along part of the war's Western Front in Belgium, around 100,000 British and German troops emerged from their trenches and met one another in the so-called no man's land between front lines. 19-year-old Henry Williamson wrote his mother, "Yesterday, the British and Germans met and shook hands in the ground between the trenches and exchanged souvenirs. Marvelous, isn't it?" A German soldier remembered that a British soldier, quote, "brought a soccer ball from their trenches, and pretty soon a lively game ensued. How marvelously wonderful, yet how strange it was." Elsewhere on the front, Captain Sir Edward Hulse recalled a Christmas sing-along that, quote, "ended up with Auld Lang Syne, which we all, English, Scots, Irish, Prussians, Wittenbergers, etc., joined in. It was absolutely astounding, and if I had seen it on a cinematograph film, I should have sworn it was faked." Hulse, who was 25 years old at the time, would be killed on the Western Front less than 4 months later. At least 17 million people would die as a direct result of the war, more than half the current population of Canada. By Christmas of 1916, soldiers didn't want truces. The devastating losses of the war and the growing use of poison gas had embittered the combatants. But many also had no idea why they were fighting and dying for tiny patches of ground so far from home. In the British trenches, soldiers began to sing the tune of Auld Lang Syne with different words. "We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here." Here was a world without whys, where life was meaninglessness all the way down. Modernity had come to war, and to the rest of life. The art critic Robert Hughes once referred to the peculiarly modernist hell of repetition, and the trenches of World War I were hell indeed. Although she was a playful and optimistic writer, Amy was not deluded about the nature of suffering or about its centrality in human life. Her work, whether picture book or memoir, always finds a way to acknowledge misery without giving in to it. One of the last lines she ever wrote was, "Death may be knocking on my door, but I'm not getting out of this glorious bath to answer it." In her public appearances, Amy would sometimes use that recursive lament of British soldiers and transform it without ever changing the tune or the words. She would ask an audience to sing that song with her, "We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here." And although it's a profoundly nihilistic song written about the modernist hell of repetition, singing this song with Amy, I could always see the hope in it. It became a statement that we are here, meaning that we are together and not alone. And it's also a statement that we are, that we exist. And it's a statement that we are here, that a series of astonishing unlikelihoods has made us possible and here possible. We might never know why we are here, but we can still proclaim in hope that we are here. I don't think such hope is foolish or idealistic or misguided. We live in hope that life will get better, and more importantly, that it will go on, that love will survive even though we will not. And we are here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. Sing it with me, wherever you are. Think of those across the broad and roaring seas. and sing with me. You won't be more off tune than I am. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. I give Auld Lang Syne 5 stars. Googling strangers. When I was a kid, my mother often told me that everyone has a gift inside them. You might be an extraordinarily astute listener of smooth jazz, or a defensive midfielder with an uncommon understanding of how to open up space with the perfect pass. But as a child, I always felt like I had no inborn gift. I wasn't a particularly good student, and I had no athletic ability. I couldn't read social cues. I sucked at piano, karate, ballet dancing, and everything else my parents tried to sign me up for. I thought of myself as a person without a specialty. But as it turned out, my specialty just hadn't been invented yet, because I am, please forgive the lack of modesty here, really, really good at Googling strangers. Sure, I've put in the work. Malcolm Gladwell famously said it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert in a field. I've clocked my 10,000 hours and then some. But also, I just have a knack for it. I Google strangers almost every day. If my wife and I have to attend a party, and I say have to because even in 2021, that is my relationship with parties, I usually research all the known attendees in advance. Of course, I know it's weird when a stranger tells you they are in the carpet installation business and you answer, "Oh yeah, I'm aware. Also, you met your wife in 1981 when you were both working at the same savings and loan institution in Dallas. She was living at home with her parents, Joseph and Marilyn, at least according to census records, while you had recently graduated from Oklahoma Baptist University. Your wedding reception at the Dallas Museum of Art was right next to that Dale Chihuly sculpture heart window. Then you moved to Indianapolis for your wife's job at Eli Lilly. How is the carpet business these days? Do you guys have like a rivalry with the hardwood floor people?" It's horrifying how much information can be accessed via Google about almost all of us. Of course, this loss of privacy has come with tremendous benefits: free storage of photos and videos, a chance to participate in large-scale discourse via social media, and the opportunity to easily keep in touch with friends from long ago. But giving so much of ourselves to private corporations like Google makes other people feel comfortable sharing their selves. This feedback loop, "we all want to be on Facebook because everyone else is on Facebook," has led to me making so much of my life publicly available that when creating accounts on new social media platforms, I often struggle to find security questions that can't be answered by studying my old social media platforms. Where did I go to elementary school? That's easy enough to find out. What was the name of my first dog? I've vlogged about our miniature dachshund Red-Green. Who was your childhood best friend? You'll find baby pictures of us tagged together on Facebook. What was your mother's maiden name? You can't be serious. But even though less of our lives belong to us and more of our lives belong to the companies that host and gather our browsing habits and hobbies and keystrokes, even though I am revolted by how easy it has become to scroll through the lives of the living and the dead, even though it all feels a bit too much like an Orwell novel, I can't outright condemn the Googling of strangers. When I was 22 and working as a student chaplain at a children's hospital, I would spend 24 hours on call once or twice a week. This meant that I'd stay in the hospital with 2 beepers. One beeper went off whenever someone asked for a chaplain. The other buzzed when a serious trauma case arrived at the hospital. One of my last nights on call, toward the end of my 6-month chaplaincy, I was asleep in the pastoral care office when the trauma pager sent me down to the emergency department. A 3-year-old child was being wheeled in. He'd suffered severe burns. I'm not sure whether it's even possible to talk about the suffering of others without exploiting that suffering, whether you can write about pain without glorifying or ennobling or degrading it. Teju Cole once said that a photograph can't help taming what it shows, and I worry the same might be true of language. Stories have to make sense, and nothing at the hospital made any sense to me at all, which is one of the reasons I've rarely written about my time there directly. I don't know the proper way through this morass, and I never have, but in telling this story, I've chosen to obscure and alter certain details. The important thing is that despite the severity of his injury, the child was conscious and in terrible pain. Although I'd been around the emergency department for months and seen all manner of suffering and death, I'd never seen the trauma team so visibly upset. The anguish was overwhelming, the smell of the burns, the piercing screams that accompanied this little boy's every exhalation. Someone shouted, "Chaplain, the scissors behind you!" And in a daze, I brought them the scissors. Someone shouted, "Chaplain, the parents!" And I realized that next to me, the little boy's parents were screaming, trying to get at their kid. But the doctors and paramedics and nurses needed enough space to work, so I had to ask the parents to step back. Next thing I knew, I was in the windowless family room in the emergency department, the room where they put you on the worst night of your life. It was quiet, except for the crying of the couple across from me. They sat on opposite sides of the couch, elbows on knees. During my training, they told me that half of marriages end within a couple years of losing a child. Weakly, I asked the parents if they wanted to pray. The woman shook her head no. The doctor came in and said that the kid was in critical condition. The parents only had one question, and it was one the doctor couldn't answer. "We'll do everything we can," she said, "but your son may not survive." Both the parents collapsed, not against each other, but into themselves. We are able to navigate the world knowing these things happen. My chaplaincy supervisor once told me, "Children have always died. It is natural." That may be true, but I can't accept it. I couldn't accept it sitting in the windowless family room, and I can't accept it now, as a father myself. When the kid finally went upstairs to the ICU and his parents followed, I walked to the break room to get a cup of coffee, and the doctor was in there, her face hovering over a trash can that she'd been vomiting into. "I'm sorry," I said. "You did good with them. Thanks for being so kind to them. I think it helped." She dry-heaved for a while and then said, "That kid's gonna die, and I know his last words. I know the last thing he'll ever say." I didn't ask her to tell me what it was, and she didn't volunteer. A week later, I finished the chaplaincy program and decided not to go to divinity school. I told everyone it was because I didn't want to learn Greek, which was true, but it was also true that I couldn't cope with the memory of this kid. I still can't cope with it. I thought about him every day. I prayed for him every day, even after I stopped praying about anything else. Every night, still, I say his name and ask God for mercy. Whether I believe in God isn't really relevant. I do believe, however tenuously, in mercy. As an inveterate Googler, I knew I could have just looked up his name, but I was too scared. To Google would have been to know one way or another. I'm reminded of that great line from Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men. The end of man is knowledge, but there is one thing he can't know. He can't know whether knowledge will save him or kill him. The months of not knowing became years, then more than a decade. And then, one morning, not long ago, I typed the kid's name into the search bar. It's an unusual name, easy pickings for Google. I hit enter. The first link was to a Facebook. I clicked over, and there he was, 18 years old, a decade and a half removed from the one night we spent together. He is alive. He is growing up, finding his way in the world, documenting a life that is more public than he probably realizes. But how can I not be grateful for knowing, even if the only way to know is to lose our autonomy over our so-called selves? He is alive. He likes John Deere tractors and is a member of the Future Farmers of America. And he is alive. Scrolling through his friends, I find his parents' profiles and discover that they are still married. He is alive. He likes terrible, overly manufactured country music. He is alive. He calls his girlfriend his bae. Alive. 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 It could have gone the other way, of course. But it didn't. And so, I can't help but give the practice of Googling strangers 4 stars. Indianapolis. Indianapolis is the 16th largest city in the U.S. by both population and land area. It is the capital of Indiana